our next guest, Scott Bullier. You've heard him before on the show. He is the chair of economics and finance and director of the Johnson Center at Troy University. He is an all-around economics guru, and he joins us on the Murphy Show hotline this morning to talk about economics, taxes, and specifically food taxes. Morning, Scott.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hope you are.
I'm doing great.
Hey, before I get into this column of yours, which is a very good one, as usual, I'm curious to drag you into the discussion concerning Birmingham and the Democrat National Convention. When conventions come to town like this, of this nature, I'm not asking you to do specific numbers on this, but do they generally provide an economic, a beneficial economic impact, particularly if the city is spending a lot of money to bring things like this in, or is it a net positive, a net neutral, or a net negative? Normal.
Well, it really depends. I think what you often see is an overselling of the benefits by city officials and state officials, and this is what we see with Olympics and major sporting events again and again. So whatever's being sold, and I'm not keen on this particular issue at the moment, it's generally something that you ought to take down in terms of the total benefits. And I'm really skeptical that
Birmingham's
going to get it too.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we'll ever have to worry about it. But yeah, I always love reading, and I'm not as learned as you on these things, obviously. But, when we start talking about multiplier effects, that's when I start getting a little, oh, there's a multiplier that you gotta take into account. I'm like, okay, you're just trying to honey up the numbers to make me a little more or a little less resistant to the idea, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, and I was involved in an exchange over in Georgia about the new Braves stadium where they were way too high with the benefits they were selling. And what happens there is they're making a case for taxpayers to pony up on the premise that their numbers are right, and often, again and again, they're way off the mark.
Scott Bullier, we lean on you when it comes to all things economics, and you're a good person to lean on considering your experience with the Johnson Center and Troy University. You write an interesting piece, and I think, you don't come at these things from a political perspective. You just basically crunch the numbers. Talk about your impetus for writing the latest piece on AL.com regarding our food taxes and the regressive nature of that tax here in the state of Alabama.
Sure. So one of the things that's a little strange, and I've been in Alabama 4 years now, is our taxes on foods and grocery sales. We have a state tax, and then most local entities add on a local sales tax to it, too. So it's anywhere from 8% in some jurisdictions to 10 or 11% in others. I'm not sure what it is up by you all, but it's about 10% here in Troy. This is something that's surprising to outsiders. You come in and you're like, wow, my grocery bill was a lot higher. And other people around the country have commented on just how perverse this is. And a study came out in 2013 saying Alabama is 10th worst in the country when it comes to what economists call the regressivity of our tax code. And that particularly means that we hit the poor very hard with some of our taxes, and this is one of the big ones.
All right, so what's the history of this? Are you familiar with the history, or are you just focused on the today, the here and now, and how it affects the poor in the state and how it ultimately leads to more government subsidy of the poor?
Yeah, so I don't know the history. I know that many have talked about eliminating it. I know that AL.com and Joey Kennedy, in fact, won a Pulitzer Prize for his contributions in this area back in the early 1990s. So it's something that's been around a long time. It's something that I think there's some common ground between Republicans and Democrats in terms of saying this is just a really bad tax, because what you're doing is you're transferring money to the poor invariably. Often you're taxing them through taxes like this, and then you're transferring more money back to them. So let's just cut out the tax in the middle and help the poor without this added burden that we're placing on them. And it's huge. And the poor we're talking about aren't just, you know, 20-year-olds who can't get a job. We're talking about elderly people who are on fixed Social Security income needing, you know, those extra dollars, but we're trying to grab them from them.
All right, and so it's a fairly simple math formula to illustrate why this has a greater burden and a greater impact on poorer people, but just walk us through it.
Sure. So when we say something's regressive, what we're saying is that as a share of your income, you're spending more than a wealthy individual. So let's say someone in Alabama is making $100,000. They're not spending that much more on groceries than a poor person who's living on $20,000. So as a fraction of your income, the taxes being paid by a poor person are much, much higher. It's somewhere between 7 and 10% in Alabama versus a wealthy individual who goes to the same grocery stores, buys slightly higher quality, more expensive items. As a share of your income, it's down around 1 or 2%. You know, so this is something that economists are very concerned about. You want a tax structure that's equitable and fair to people, and this is one that just simply isn't.
I mean, isn't that the case with all or most taxes, though, Scott?
It is. So, you know, sales taxes are something that many economists favor. And, you know, you buy a car, and, of course, that's going to be regressive, too. The issue with the food tax is it's just one that's so essential to individuals in terms of their consumption and something that so few other states rely on as a means of raising revenue. We're one of only seven that tries to hit it at the maximum level.
You know, I've had this conversation, as you might expect, in my experience in Alabama since 1999. I've had the conversation often. And invariably, be they Democrats, Republicans, whatever political stripe, whatever ideology, we always get to the point where we agree, okay, it affects poor people more greatly. Yes, we should probably do something about this. Yes, we should probably either reduce or totally eliminate taxes on the sale of food items. But then there's the how do we replace that revenue coming into state coffers, and that's always the devil in the details.
That's right. You know, and I think that that's unfortunate that we let revenue revenue calculations guide us on what is just the right thing to be doing, you know, because what happens then is it just becomes a default where we'll keep this tax because we don't know what to do about the revenue issue. It's a bad tax. It should go. I think that some of the revenue claims being made are overstated. Some people think it's as much as $350 million in terms of the revenue hit. You have to think through some of the dynamic effects of lifting this tax. People on the borders go to Florida for their groceries instead of staying here in Alabama. Same with Georgia and the other border effects. Some people are able to shop on military bases thanks to the fact that they're tax-free. Now, you've seen the back-to-school shopping when you have tax-free holidays on just school items. Look at the bonanza people have just on a few days of tax-free status. Imagine what could happen to grocery sales in the state as well.
Well, and you make the case in the piece, and I want folks to go and read it. I won't read all of it for them, but you make the case that the argument in support of the food tax are deeply flawed, and you say because they're largely premised on our state government being first and foremost a money-making entity in constant search of ways to grab revenue at the lowest political cost. In other words, what I hear you saying, Scott, is that there are powerful people that don't want to replace this revenue. Well, they don't want to deal with not replacing it and don't want to replace it in ways like, I don't know, increased property tax burdens or other ways because they don't like that, and they have more sway at the state house.
That's absolutely right. And good God, they don't want to ever entertain the idea of cutting, you know, which is something that is implicit in my argument here is, all right, if we're going to put the issue of revenue on the table, let's look line by line at budgets and see where there actually is room to cut. We have a very high fraction of our public sector employees in public sector jobs. We're much higher than national averages. If we have to put this revenue issue on the table, then let's actually deal with it and get some meaningful reform. You know, that won't happen. The only time that lawmakers talk about revenue is when they need more of it. So it's biased in the direction of, the burden's on you to make an argument for reform, and then you're not allowed to actually go down that road unless you can address it.
Remind you, our guest is Scott Bullier. He is economics professor and director of the Johnson Center down at Troy University. We're talking about food taxes and the regressive nature of said same. Hey, it occurred to me during the break, Scott, is would you consider gasoline taxes to be more regressive than food taxes, considering in Alabama we find automobiles such a necessity most of the time?
They are. A lot of those taxes are coming from the federal level, but it's the same general principle that indeed a lot of folks who drive are on fixed incomes, you know, and it, as a share of an income, it's a lot more than someone who's making $100,000. So same general principle, yes.
All right, so I talk to these politicos quite often, as you might expect in my daily life. Del Marsh, head of the Senate, President Pro Tem of the Senate, Mike Hubbard with the Speaker of the House's office, and, of course, the governor, Robert Bentley. And all of them tell me that they've made great strides in streamlining and cutting government. From what I'm feeling and hearing from you, you think that government could go a lot further.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that if you place the burden on people who have, you know, just very reasonable ideas about reform and you say, well, we have to address the revenue aspect of this, and you don't look at the revenue aspect in a big enough picture, there's no hope for reform. Since the Great Recession of 2008, no matter how austere people are in their rhetoric, our state spending has grown by about 25% over the last, you know, 5 years. That's not a government that's keeping spending in check. And if you place that burden on us, who, you know, people saying this is a tax that's just killing us, and say you can't change it unless you address a revenue source, you're not looking at the big picture that revenues and expenditures have been rising like crazy. So you can't get anything done under that particular scenario. You know, cap expenditures, and then let's have a conversation about it.
I mean, but in a state that I think the last time I looked, and it was a number of years ago, I think it was 58% of our revenues come in the form of sales taxes, and I would expect that a lot of that, and I know I'm doing what you say I ought not to be doing right now, Scott, trust me, but I know that the politicians will need to figure out a way to reduce or replace the money that they lose, whatever amount it is, whether it's $370 million or whatever it is. So when you're talking like this, then I have to ask, well, I mean, is there a political wherewithal or a political will to do the heavy lifting to reduce the size of government or to replace the money and get this done?
I don't know. You know, I'm not keen to what they're thinking about meaningful reform. There are ways to do it and other states to look at. West Virginia, in fact, just did it. They're one of the states that's moved away from the grocery tax completely. They phased it in gradually over a few years. So the nice thing about a gradual phase is you can lower the tax a little bit and just see how big those revenue issues are. If you hang your hat on a study that says it's going to be a $350 million impact, you have to have faith in all of those things we started the show talking about, multipliers and, you know, various scenarios that really aren't captured until you actually take action. So you're missing a lot in, you know, just trusting a particular study in terms of revenue impact.
Our guest is Scott Beaulieu. He's with Troy University, professor of economics at Troy and director of the Johnson Center. I want to trampoline off this discussion because I think it's a very compelling one, and talk about a recent article you wrote about state-run lotteries. You look at state-run lotteries as simply a bad idea. Tell us why.
You know, so I think that they're a bad idea if they're driven by the idea that we have to get some more revenue for our state governments. And that's the premise of that piece. I personally don't have a major problem with gambling. If Alabama wants to make a decision to say, you know, people should be free to have a little more fun, that's fine. But if it's all premised on the state can be this really great moneymaker and will advertise like crazy and possibly fund a new pet project like the Hope Scholarship does in Georgia, that's all for the wrong reasons. And if you look at who actually plays the lottery, it's these people we're talking about when I'm talking about regressive taxes, people who are very poor, people who generally aren't very educated, and you're only allowing a state option. When is the government efficient at anything? Seldom, and they're not very efficient in terms of running a good lottery. They're a high-cost provider of lotteries. Their payouts are worse than the private sector. So if we want to have this conversation about new revenue sources and, you know, allow gambling, then let's, you know, maybe talk about that, you know, in terms of, like, possibly private sector provision.
Or, you know, I got another idea, too, and I know I'm dragging you into the political end of this, but offer a contract, and the governor could do this by himself, offer a contract with the Indian gaming interest and say, we will allow for you to open up your gaming interest. You pay us X amount of percent of the total take. We'll put together a board or some such to make sure that everything is above board and everything's being done in the proper manner, and go at it from there and let the Indians worry about the overhead. I mean, they're already engaging in a form of gambling anyway, so why not expand it that way?
Yeah. See, and that's the point of my piece, which came out last week, is that if we're going to go down this road, a state-run lottery is probably the most inefficient, horrible way to be doing it, especially since what happens is governments become really dependent on those revenue streams. If people, you know, good God, actually decide to stop playing the lottery and become just a little more informed about the odds of winning, which are very, very low, all of a sudden now we have a new unfunded liability that we get to look forward to. And this has happened in Georgia. They've had wild swings in their lottery revenues, and it's led to all kinds of modifications on the Hope Scholarship. Some years it's this much money, some years it's this. And do we really need to be doing this?
No.
It's the point of the column.
Well, and you know what? I'll just from a personal experience, the wife and I go to Georgia often because I have family over there. And, you know, when the thing's up, you know, to a certain amount, when we stop to get gas, oh, yeah, sure, we'll, you know, get a ticket just for fun. And frankly, and I know I'm profiling here, Scott, the people that I see in line buying $60 and $70 and $80 worth of tickets, I just want to beg them, just please take that money and save it or go buy food. You know, I mean, you need other things other than the hope of something that's simply never going to happen. Never going to happen.
That's right. You know, about a third of people never play. A third are like you or me. We'll play when the pot gets really big and just it's kind of for fun. But about a third of people are just completely addicted, and it's just, you know, straight from their paycheck to the gas station to get lottery tickets.
Scott, a compelling conversation. Unfortunately, we have to end it. I appreciate you and appreciate the piece. I invite people to go read it on AL.com. That's Scott Bullier, professor of economics at Troy. Thanks, Scott. Back in a moment.